My name is Sebastian Schinzel. I'm a postdoc researcher from University of Erlangen at the chair of Felix Freiling. Isabel Schmidt couldn't, unfortunately, come here today. She's a student of mine. She works for me. And what I'm going to present today is most of the parts of her bachelor thesis, right? So she did most of the measurements. So okay, what are web application firewalls? So first of all, so you usually have one web server and there's some application on this running, some web application. And the assumption that we have, especially in this crowd here, is that these web applications have some vulnerabilities. Okay, so and we want to protect the vulnerabilities that are located in this web application from the internet, and on this internet there are the attackers. Okay, so this is our assumption. I'm not going to show you new vulnerabilities. We just have this assumption. There are attacker on this internet, right? And they already know security vulnerabilities in this web application. Okay, and then a web application firewall is usually configured in a way that it's in between the internet and therefore the attackers and the web application, right? So we create a firewall which is supposed to intercept the web request, and a web application firewall also has some filter rules in order to decide what is an attack and what is a benign request, just a normal request. Another thing is the quality of this web application firewall really depends on the quality of the filter rules. So if there's a new attack coming on, a new type of cross-site scripting, let's put it this way, then this web application firewall will be blind to this kind of attack if the filter rules don't cover this, okay? Another thing is, most of the times, the administrators of this web application firewall, they try to keep their active filter rules a secret, because there's really no reason to communicate this to everyone on the web, how your filter rules look like, because this makes an attack much easier for the attacker, because the attacker can really look at your filter rules and then change the exploit in a way so that it goes through the filter rules and executes an attack at the web application. So the research question that Isabel and I had was, so what can an attacker learn about the active filter rule set of a web application firewall? So we're not looking into specific holes of specific implementations of web application firewalls. We just want to have one black box firewall and want to learn something about the active filter rules. Okay, some related work. There are already two tools which do something similar what we do. So first of all, there's a tool which is called WAFWOOF, and this one can be used in order to detect whether there is a web application firewall at all, and what is the producer of this firewall. So you just run this tool, it's a simple Python script, and then it looks at certain things at the HTTP header, for example, or the HTTP status codes, and decides from there whether there is a web application firewall and which producer. A second tool is called WAFTester, and this does a very similar thing which we are trying to do. It looks at the responses and looks at error messages that are located in the response of the HTTP response. Okay. So then let's just think about what can an attacker learn just from observing HTTP responses. Right, so there are three cases that an attacker can observe. The first is the response shows a web application firewall error response. So there's something like written, the web application firewall XYZ decided that this is an attack and therefore it was blocked. Okay, that's very straightforward. In this case, we learn that there was a rogue request and it was blocked by the WAF, or the WAF passed this request on to the web application, which crashed. So there was some error, maybe an HTTP 500 or so, and then this HTTP error 500 was cloaked by the WAF. And cloaking is something like the web application firewall takes an error message that was generated by the web application and then rewrites it to a more generic error message. The reason for this would be, let's say there's a stack trace which came up in the web application and you don't want this to be leaked to the attacker. The second case is that the response shows an error response by the web application. And in this case, we definitely know that the WAF did not block the request because it went through and caused some error condition there, right? So we know this one was passed. And then we have the third possibility, and there we just see just a normal response. And there we have overall three. There are a few more, but there are three general possibilities what happened here. So first of all, the web application firewall could have removed the exploit that I just sent to the web application firewall. The next thing is the WAF passed the rogue request, but the web application just was not, they did know error happened, right? So no error came up. And so most certainly the exploit was just ignored. So the exploit didn't really work without causing an error condition. And third and the last, the web application firewall passed the request on to the web application. The exploit was triggered, but there was no visible response. Something like a blind SQL injection, for example. Okay, what are timing side channel attacks? That's a very simple case of timing side channel attacks. On the left side, you have an attacker. On the right side, you have a server. And this server is just a login interface, nothing more. And it just two things. First of all, it checks whether the username was correct. And second of all, it looks whether the password was correct. And there's a timing side channel in here, because if the user was correct, the error message that the web application returns will be returned immediately without checking for the password. And only if the username was correct, only then the password is triggered. So, and even though this error message is exactly the same, an attacker which is measuring here the response times can find out whether the username was correct or not. So that's a very simple case for a timing side channel. And we want to combine this. How can we do this? Okay. So this is the same picture that you have just seen before. Here we have the internet. Here in the DMZ, we have a reverse proxy standing. And on this reverse proxy, we have installed the web application firewall Mod Security. That's a free web application firewall available on the internet. And here again, we have the web server running the internet. Running the web application, not the internet. Okay, and now, when there's a request coming in, this request will be hit by the web application firewall. Then the web application firewall does the scanning, and if the WAF decides that this is a benign request, not an attack, only then will it pass the request on to the web server. Otherwise, we have these red dotted arrows here. Otherwise, the request will be blocked immediately, so it will not be passed to the web application, and then error message is immediately returned. So that's the first scenario that we are looking at. We overall, we looked at three scenarios. The second scenario is this here. There, we don't have a reverse proxy here in the middle. We just have the web server, and the WAF was loaded as a plugin to the web server, right? When you think about timing, it's just one slide back, right? So here we would expect there's a pretty large timing difference between the green ones and the red ones. And in our second scenario, it should be smaller, right? That's what we would suggest. We have a third scenario, and there we couldn't use Mod Security anymore. We wanted to include the intrusion detection system, the web application firewall directly as a programming library into the application that we're scanning. And PHP IDS is such a thing. It's actually an intrusion detection system, but which can be used in a way that it mimics a web application firewall. Right, and here we have a very slight difference between the green and the red arrows. It would only mean that in the former cases, the web application, the request would never hit the web server. This would be the first scenario. The second scenario would be the request would hit the web server, actually, but not the web application. And in this case, it would actually even hit the web application because the WAF is loaded as a programming library. So here we would expect the least timing difference. So what is our idea behind our tool? We call our tool Waffle. So first, in the first step, the attacker takes an exploit. Let's say this is a valid cross-site scripting exploit. We just imagine this one would be triggered in the web application. And then he generates what we call a polymorphic representations of this code. A polymorphic representation of an exploit is you change the exploit in a way that it's semantically still the same, but on a byte level, it looks different. And we do this in order to evade the filtering rules which are active in the web application firewall. And what we ultimately find out is which of these gets through the web application firewall, which are blocked, and which go through. And when one goes through, we know exactly that this is a valid exploit. Okay, in the second step, we send each of these polymorphic representations to the web application, and then we measure the response time. Okay, and then we did this, and this was the first this was the first result that we received. So here we just took one request where we knew this would definitely go through the web application firewall, and then we used another one which contained an attack and which was supposed to be blocked. And when you look at this, this here is the time axis, and this are just the amount of requests that we did. The red ones are the requests that were blocked, and the green ones were the one which were passed. And you see there's a substantial timing difference, in this case about 50 milliseconds, so it's really large. So it looks very promising, but still you see there is one of these red, so there's a passed request which slipped above this cloud of the past request just because of jitter, right? So you always have the problem when you do a timing attack on the internet that there's a lot of jitter, that there's a lot of delay that gets randomly added to the response time. Okay, in order to filter this jitter out, we came up with a methodology in order to filter out this jitter. Okay, so the methodology works in two steps. The first step is the learning phase. And in the learning phase, what we do is we generate a lot of requests which we know are passed. So no exploits in this case. We just do a normal GET request to this particular URL. Okay, and then we measure the response time. And this cloud here is the response time. And from this cloud here, we determine what we call the blocking boundary. And the blocking boundary is just the minimum response time of all possible past requests. Okay? Then we take this blocking boundary as a parameter for the second phase, which is the attack phase. And there we define, when we find any response time which is below the blocking boundary, we know it was blocked, right? And why is that? The reason for this is the passed requests are those requests that are passed to the web application, right? And if we measure a lot of them, we get this lower boundary, the blocking boundary. And if any request is shorter, we can assume that this particular request was not sent to the web application, but it was blocked by the web application firewall. Okay, so in this case here, we have a blocked request. That's good that we know it's a blocked request. If we have one request here, we have a problem because it could either be a passed request with low jitter, or it could be a blocked request with high jitter. Right? So it could be one response time which should be actually here, but there was a lot of delay on the network, and therefore it slipped above the blocking boundary. So if we have a blocked request down here, we know for sure it's a blocked request. If we are up here, we have to remeasure. So we have to do some more measurements in order to affirm on a certain confidence level that this is really that this is really a past request. Okay, in this picture, we just I just show the learning phase in a sense, and here you see those are all the past requests, and this blue line here, this is this boundary which we define is the blocking boundary. Okay, let's look at the results. This is our first scenario where we use mod security on the reverse proxy, where we expected the largest timing gap to appear. And we generated about 5,000 requests, 5,000 different types of exploits, and sent this over to the web application firewall. And here you see all the ones that are marked in red were the ones where we knew that these should be blocked. And all the green ones were the ones where we knew they should be passed, right? We could determine this from the log file. And there you see you have, not many outliers, right? So you have a few of them going up here because of the network noise. And we have one down here, which we wouldn't expect. And the reason for this is we used one blocking boundary for all the URLs of our web application, right? So we were lazy. We just took one URL out and measured the blocking boundary of this particular thing and just had the assumption that all URLs have the same response time. In reality, this is not the case, right? And this is what we are seeing here. There was one particular URL which has a very low response time, and therefore this slipped below this. We could be more, if we hadn't been that lazy, we would have to determine this blocking boundary for each and every URL of this particular web application. Okay, so that worked. In the first scenario, this worked quite well. Now let's look at the second scenario, and there we have we don't have a TCP round trip anymore, right? So the web application firewall is loaded on the same web server, which is also hosting the web application. So we would assume that it's a bit slower, but what we see here, it's actually bigger. Right? So the timing gap that we're seeing here is actually bigger than compared to the reverse proxy. And we think, so we don't know for sure why this is the case, but we think that it's just the case because a web application firewall, the filtering of the web application firewall is quite expensive for the CPU, right? So filtering is quite expensive, and therefore hosting the WAF and the web application on the same web server actually increased the response time. Here we have the third scenario, and in this third scenario, it's not only running on the same web server, it's also running on the same web application. We use a PHP web application, that means in this case also mod PHP is also running, right? So we would assume here would be, the timing difference would be very low, and it is actually lower compared to the second scenario, but still it's we see that most of these are quite unique here, just visually looking at these. Okay, let's sum up these results. So in all three of our scenarios, we saw when we just visually looked at the responses, we already saw that there's a significant difference between blocked request and passed request. And if you do only a single measurement in our scenario, only a single measurement will determine whether it's a blocked or a passed request in more than 95% of all cases. Okay, so that's quite good. And obviously we can increase these 95% as much as we want, up to 100%, by just repeating the measurements and doing some statistical work. But we didn't even have to do statistical work, right, which is really good. What I didn't mention is we did these measurements over the internet. So we started the measurements at the University of Mannheim, so from Germany to a cloud provider, I think it was in France. So there was something like 15 hops on the internet. Right, so this is not a laboratory. It's not a laboratory. It's really on the internet. Okay, there's one more thing. So we did these timing measurements, and they worked quite well. And therefore, we decided we want to do a little bit more. And then we ported our tool, Waffle, in order to do what is called a so-called cross-site request forgeries. Okay, and here you see the scenario is a bit different. Here we have our web application that we've already seen. Here's the web application firewall, and here is our attacker, right? So and you see there's no direct connection to the attacker. So what the attacker does is he ported Waffle in JavaScript and hosted this on some web page. And what he now has to do is he just tricks any user on the internet to visit this particular web page. And this web page will execute Waffle in the browser of this web user and will do all the fingerprinting. So all the real requests doing the measurement will be done from this unsuspecting web user, and it can be many web users. This is also a very interesting part. So you can distribute this attack to maybe 100 users or so that only each user only has to do maybe a few dozens or a few hundred requests. Okay, that's just how the code looked like. So what we actually did is we just generate an image tag, right? And this image tag has an on-arrow handler. Here we start the timing, right, and load this particular image. The image loading will fail because whatever we'll get back will not be a valid image. So therefore, the on-arrow handler will fire in any case, in any case. So in here we have the starting time, here we have the end time, and then we just send this result to the attacker. Right, so only the web user is directly communicating with the attacker and with the web application. And these are the results, right? So they are more coarse-grained because in the former case we could do measurements which are something like on a nanosecond level. In this case, we only have milliseconds, which we can measure, but still it's enough. Okay, just a short summary. So we introduced a new timing attack against web application firewalls. The good thing about this is that our attack against the web application firewalls always works. So we don't have to rely on some error messages because a securely configured web application firewall will be transparent. Right, so there will be no error messages which determine which web application firewall is active here. In our case, it always works, and it doesn't matter on error messages and things like that. Okay, we tested the attack over an internet connection, so it's very realistic. It works, and also we combined our timing attack with cross-site request forgery, and this has actually two advantages. The first advantage is it hides the attacker's identity. So the attacker never gives out his IP address, and it prevents the web application firewall from blocking the attack. So if there's a web application firewall which learns that there's some kind of fingerprinting or denial of service attack, it could just block the IP, but in this case it's not possible because we're distributing the attack over many IPs. Okay, thank you very much. We have some time for questions.
Hi. How resilient do you think the timing phase of your attack would be to normal variations on server load, its ability to respond to your requests in a consistent time frame? And a second question is also for the distributed attack, how resilient would that be to variations in latencies from the different clients connecting to the server?
Okay. So I did a lot of timing attacks and timing measurements on the internet, also in my dissertation. And what I always wanted to do is to use some kind of denial of service attack in order to increase a timing gap. So let's assume there's a server, and this server has, let's say there's a timing leak, which is just a microsecond, which is a bit too small. I want to increase this. And then I could do, a denial of service attack so that it gets loaded, right? So the server is loaded, and there's a lot of load on it, and so that it gets increased to, let's say, 10 milliseconds or so. But the results I got there were never good, right? So first of all, it depends on the operating system. For example, Linux seems so it basically ignored everything. So there was a Linux server, and I put a lot of load on this Linux server, and the response time didn't increase significantly. Whereas when you do this on Mac OS X, for example, it will increase, right? So that didn't answer your question, actually, isn't it? Yeah, okay. So what you were saying is, like, what happens if there's a server which is under heavy load, right? And what happens then? Okay, in my so what I have seen, it depends. It depends on the server, it depends on the hardware, it depends on the operating system. But usually, when you have a problem with a lot of noise, you just have to do more measurements. You cannot prevent, let's say, the attack of a timing leak just by adding more jitter, because the attacker can just measure more and then put some statistical analysis on it. Did this answer your question?
Yes. Okay. So do you think then for the distributed version of the attack that might be a built-in requirement, or is that in your estimation not much of a factor?
It's not that much of a factor, I would suggest. I mean, when you it could be the case that when I distribute the attack to many users, that the users have different qualities. So there are people sitting in a very idle university network which has very good quality, and then there are, let's say, dial-up users from some other country or so which have significant noise in there or so. But the attacker still gets the results. So the attacker could pick out those users which have high quality links, right? So you can do this, right? And the attacker also, he knows what the timing gap is supposed to be. He can find this out. And if there's a user which deviates a lot from these values, he could just throw away these users and use some other users.
So some initial, like, filtering or pre-processing of the data could eliminate those.
Yes,
others.
Yes. You can do a lot of with statistics here. Thank you.
You mentioned the TCP round-trip times that were contributing to the gap, but isn't it more of the load of processing the request? Mm-hmm. I mean, I wouldn't suggest that the TCP round-trip time adds a lot of delay mm-hmm. compared to the delay from processing. Mm-hmm.
And that's what we saw. That's what we saw, right? But intuitively, that was when I talked to Isabel, what results we're expecting, I thought that this would be larger, but it was not the case.
I mean, a typical TCP round-trip time would be, I don't know, on a local network, maybe a millisecond or even below that. So
exactly.
You were measuring 50 milliseconds mm-hmm. timing difference, so
yeah.
That basically plays no role, right?
Yeah, and it didn't, okay. You're right. Okay.
My question goes as a solution to this problem. Mm-hmm. Would putting a delay, kind of sleep command in the web application firewalls to delay the block response in order to make it equal to when the request passes through the firewall, would that solve this problem?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you're saying something like adding a random delay in order
not
to...
Not random, like deterministic, exactly like user password checking. Type of timing attack, one solution is to add delay or make the delays equal, mm-hmm. whether or not user or password doesn't match.
In theory, that's a very good idea. In practical environments, you will have a hard time estimating the amount of time to wait. So what is the correct amount of time to wait?
So attacker does this. To perform this attack, a remote attacker can do it. So the server owner can also do it, right?
I think I misunderstood your question.
Oh, sure. Basically, attacker, the system admin determines the time difference between when a request is mm-hmm. blocked and when the request passes through the firewall and getting process and gets processed and basically responded back to the user, and the difference between these two is the delay to put, before the block response goes back to the user, so that those two responses gets the same amount of delay between being sent to the user. So from the attacker's point of view, user or potential attacker's point of view, you get the same delay whether or not the response, the request is being blocked or processed.
In a practical environment, this is very hard to do, because in many cases, then you have maybe a load balancer in front, right, which distributes the request to several different hardware servers, right? So the delay that you have to add differs among the different servers and even the URLs. So your suggestion is good, but in practical environments, it's very hard to do. So there's a lot of bookkeeping to
do. I see.
You know, there are ways of, and there's also related work which they do a delay, they add a delay, and they have different strategies. So the first strategy is just to add a random delay. The problem here is that with the appropriate statistics, you can factor this out, right? And then there are other types of delays, but the problem really here is we have delays of something like 50 milliseconds or so, and if you want to do a proper delay, it would be around a second or so, and this is not practical. Right? You can't just delay 1 second or so. That's too much for practical environments.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Any more questions? Doesn't seem so. Okay. Thank you very much.